Yes, it's that time with DLC, your downloadable content for the week. DLC delivered the way it's meant to be, completely free. And that is thanks to our sponsors this week, New Relic and FreshBooks. We appreciate them making that possible, delivering the show to you for free. Of course, DLC is the show all about gaming in its many forms, games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles, and also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm Jeff Cannata, your host, and I'm joined by my co-host, slash nemesis, slash friend, the man who once built a Lego version of himself so lifelike, it co-hosted three shows with me, Christian Spicer.
I like that intro. Thank you very much. Yeah, hey Jeff, happy to be here. It took years of work, but it was worth it.
Dude, I'm all about Lego this week. I'm just so high on the Lego movie. And of course, this is the show, DLC. What is it? It's the show that advises you to display your Lego creations.
Nice.
And it's also, you know, your downloadable Cannata, your downloadable Christian. And this week, it means our direct link to Chicago, because we've got Patrick Klepek on the line from the Windy City, Mr. Scoops himself, the awesome news guy at Giant Bomb, TED Talker, and of course, daily Spelunky streamer. Welcome, Patrick.
Yeah, and as of today, no longer has a soul, because if anyone, you know, was watching my Spelunky stream or watches an archive of it when it goes up on the site, moments ago,
we're in Spelunky and got ever so close to beating your rival's score.
Yeah, I have an ongoing rivalry with newly left to Campo Santo, Chris Remo, who was formerly the community manager over at Double Fine. He's a friend of mine. We go way, way back. And
is he still a friend of yours?
Well, frenemy. Let's use frenemy. Friends in real life, enemies in Spelunky. And he's been addicted to Spelunky for, you know, since it, I think, came out on the PC. I am really new. I've only been playing for since the beginning of January, but I play it every day on Giant Bomb Live, and we do the daily, which for folks that aren't familiar with Spelunky, essentially, Spelunky randomizes certain elements of its level design every time you play it. And in the daily, it's the same level for everyone on that 24-hour period. So kind of levels the playing field and allows you to compete with other people in a way that you can't otherwise. And him and I have gotten this rivalry growing, and he had an amazing day today, like an insurmountable amount of money collected, and he beat Yama, which is the second secret boss in that game. And I managed to make it all the way to Yama, and I'm not that familiar with that boss. I've only been there. That's only my second time there. Screwed up beating him, and had I beat him, I would have beaten Chris. And I believe someone said that when he finished his run last night, that he would have killed himself if Patrick somehow managed to beat his score. So maybe it's good that I didn't actually beat him. Maybe that was just life stepping in. But it's you know, an hour kind of down the tubes, and but it makes you feel alive. There are a few video games that remind you are alive. Spelunky reminds me of that on a daily basis.
That's pretty high praise, and I have not ventured into the Spelunky waters. I'm scared of how addicted I would be, just based on how much I loved Rogue Legacy last year, and how many hours I poured into that game. And I feel like they're sort of spiritually linked, those kinds of games. But I love watching you play, and I love the community that's built up around that game. It's just it's awesome.
I was going to say, the only reason that Spelunky makes you feel alive is because you think about killing yourself after every game.
Well, it's because most video games, you don't have anything to lose. You know, the most you're going to lose is progress, and most games these days have even erased that as a consequence. And I think there are all sorts of good reasons for that, you know, especially in terms of getting more people into video games. And also, you know, some of the progression that you would lose in some games, it doesn't feel fair. But everything in Spelunky is 100% fair. Everything that happens is your fault. The game has very strict, very specific rules that you have to abide by. And when you flatten the playing field and everyone's playing on the same level, it just adds so many emotional stakes to it. And because it's a relatively short period of time that you're playing, about an hour if you manage to do everything in the game, I don't know. It's just you either win everything or you lose everything. When I lost today, sure, I got second place, but second place is the first loser. So I really didn't get a whole lot.
Well, hopefully we'll get a whole lot out of this episode of DLC. We're hoping you will contribute, you who are listening live right now at 5by5.tv/live. We have a phone number you can call in and participate in the conversation throughout the episode. That number is 512-518-5714. If you're listening to this later on download, hopefully you can hang out with us. We record every Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific time. You can join in on the chat room at 5by5.tv/chat or call us 512-518-5714. And of course, we start every episode with the story of the week. Story of the week. It's the story of the week. Story of the week. It's the story of the week. It finally happened. It finally happened. Remix was sent in. That was sent in by Patrick L. from Sweden, who sent in that remix of my.
He's my brother. That's brother from Sweden.
That is awesome. And of course, Story of the Week is the part of the show where we try to convince each other what the most important story or our favorite story of the last week in the world of gaming is. Patrick, we'll let you go first. What caught your fancy this week as the most important story of the week?
You know, I mean, it's a lot of ink has been spilled. A lot of words have been said about Flappy Bird. But I think part of the reason Flappy Bird has caught people's attention is there's a lot of stories within the larger, you know, the singular story of Flappy Bird being a successful kind of out of nowhere video game. But you know, as someone that, you know, you mentioned I gave a TED talk about internet discourse, you know, I've been especially compelled by the reaction to the developer's decision to take down the game. He has not been explicit about why exactly he's doing that. You know, he has expressed the feelings in the past week or so about the amount of attention he's been getting, the amount of attention the game's been getting. So he has relayed that he's had some anxiety about the game's success. And I think it's sort of, you know, it doesn't really matter if he's taking it down because of stress or any other reason. I think all it takes is a cursory look at the term Flappy Bird on Twitter to see the huge amount of death threats that he has received as a result of the decision that I also think most people don't understand what he's doing, because by taking it down, it's not removing it from their phone. Right. Apple does have a kill switch that they can use on apps, but as far as I know, they have never actually used that kill switch. It's meant for malware and things that could really compromise the device. You know,
they decide to take over the world.
Yeah,
kill switch everyone's phones.
But you know, like people snuck emulators and things like that onto the App Store before by hiding it in other innocuous apps, and they've never thrown the kill switch on that. If you manage to download it in time, you get to keep it on your phone. And yet, nonetheless, folks have sent a lot of abuses way. And you know, I pointed that out earlier this week. Someone had made a Twitter list that included everything, a lot of what had been targeted at him. And you know, when I tweeted that out, the reaction I got from a lot of folks was, well, he's making $50,000 a day. You know how much I put up with for that kind of money. And, right. You know, I see their point. You know, I definitely see why someone would have that reaction. But I also think that shows a distinct lack of empathy when you're not the person being targeted with these threats. And while it's easy to look at an internet threat as just a guy saying something idle on Twitter or Facebook or YouTube, I think it's a really disturbing part about internet culture and not game culture, which I'd like to be specific about, that has led to us just accepting threats as something that you're just supposed to live with as a part of success.
Yeah, it's hard to argue that this isn't the biggest story of the week, because we have people submit story of the week contenders with a hashtag DLCSOTW, DLC story of the week. And this was submitted by three different people, at Eric Elfman, at Ilnik31, and at Hey It's Lunker, who all wanted to talk about this story. But as you point out, Patrick, it's really interesting how many facets of this story we can talk about. And I'm so glad to have you on this episode to talk about it, because as you said, your TED talk, which if anybody has not listened to, I urge you to go to YouTube and find it. I don't know if you have a better link to tell people to find
if
it.
If you just well, if like, you just search Patrick Lubick TED, it should come up on
yeah,
YouTube.
Yeah,
it was a TEDx. Let's be honest, right? I mean, Patrick's a great guy, but he's second in Splunky, and it was a TEDx talk. Let's just get that out there.
The TEDx organization is actually super specific about that stuff. Like I was told when I was writing my talk, and for people who don't know, the distinction between TED and TEDx is TED is like J.J. Abrams, you know, people of that level of giving talks. And then TEDx is are community organized. And those can float up to the TED stuff, but it is different. And they told me when I was writing, like, make sure you say TEDx if you ever say the phrase TED in your speech, because they've had instances in the past where someone says TED instead of TEDx, and they just won't feature it because they're that.
they don't want to piss off J.J. Abrams. That's what
I guess. I didn't even get approved to give a TED Z talk. So
I was in a podcast with J.J. Abrams where he had to pay to go to TED himself.
Yeah. I mean, you really should listen to Patrick's talk. It is so fantastic, and it is speaking to something that I've been very much interested by and in the last few years. And I think all of us who are tied into the video game community and the internet community as on the whole are interested in. And that is the sort of level of discourse that everybody is dealing with, and this abuse that seems to be par for the course if you are in the public eye and on Twitter or Facebook or any of these social media platforms. And, you know, we saw this last year with Phil Fish feeling like he was not interested in participating in that kind of scenario anymore and kind of taking his ball and going home with regard to making the sequel to his game, which is leaving my brain for the moment.
Fez 2.
Yeah. Anyway, and this is sort of the same thing that's happening again. The designer of Flappy Birds, Dong Yuen, seems to be a guy who was very, very interactive with his Twitter account, which exploded in the last few months, going from like 300 followers to over 130,000 followers. And there's numerous sites that are listing lots of his tweets and his back and forth and how they sort of steadily decline into this apologizing for his game and urging people to play less of it and disconnect. As you point out, Patrick, the number of death threats that he was getting, and you know, Flappy Bird is a frustrating game by design. That's sort of the whole hook of it, is that it is extremely difficult and will frustrate you. But I think it was more than that. There was this other level of vitriol that was aimed his way, and you bring up a really interesting point that I wanted to hit on as well, which is this weird feeling in, I want to say, American culture, but I think it's world culture too, that if you're making a lot of money, all of a sudden everything that is tied to your humanity or your emotional state should be thrown out the window. Like, money justifies anything, which it seems completely irrational to me. I mean, one of my favorite things that I saw in this story, this guy, Dong Yuen, is becoming one of my favorite people, just kind of reading his reaction to things. Because one of the things he tweeted out most recently was this quote, "A man only lives once, and the best strategy is always to make the most of it. Success is not the only reason for existence." And I love that. I mean, I think that we get, yeah, his game was a big success, and he could sell lots more copies of it, especially now that it's in the news in such a big way. This is great PR in a sense for his game, but to pull it down and to sort of have priorities that aren't just monetary, I respect that. And I think that, you know, I think that shows a little bit of credibility on his part. But Christian, what do you think?
I mean, I want to believe that's true. I think it's unfortunate what happened. I think what's interesting about this story is, you know, I believe it was Kotaku that, you know, published a rather harsh piece and have since published an official apology, you know, about that piece. But it's I think the reason or a reason why a lot of people might be skeptical is this kind of thing is happening the same time Shia LaBeouf is wearing a paper bag on the red carpet and saying he's not famous anymore. And Joaquin Phoenix spent a year pretending he was crazy. But of course, that was all, well, the Casey Affleck documentary. I think there's skepticism in even people saying they don't want attention, saying that people are quick to think, and sometimes rightly, sometimes wrongly, that's a bigger ploy for attention. And you have this game that's super successful, and then you just start saying all this stuff. You know, I think people are like, why did he say anything at all? Why did he engage in this? And I'm not saying that that argument is correct, but I understand the feeling and I understand the skepticism. I think to me,
well,
the biggest...
Well, do you think that a person that was doing it for self-promotion would pull their app down when they could be selling more copies as a result of the controversy? Yeah.
Yes, to some extent. I mean, it depends what the long play is, right? Is there another game coming? Does this game then come back a few weeks later? I'm not saying that he's doing that, and I don't know at all. I mean, Patrick knows because he knows everything 2 weeks before it happens. So I want to know what Patrick's next story of the week is, next week's story. but, you know, I understand the skepticism. I don't agree with, like, the vitriol and the hate, you know, being thrown this guy's way and the snap judgment. I think, unfortunately, and I've been guilty of this, I think, Jeff, you know, you have too, where you're in the heat of the moment and you tweet something that you end up regretting, be it, you know, you didn't get something that you wanted in terms of, like, for me, like, you know, like a booking fell through or something like that, or, you know, sports outcome or whatever, right? And then I think people here, they think that they're almost talking to themselves via Twitter. Like, it's just this thing of my ramblings, and they forget that, you know, we see all this stuff, right? And it hurts people's feelings.
Saying stuff and at replying people are, I think, are two different things. But I don't know, the sort of cynical view of it that he's doing it all for self-promotion, I don't know. It doesn't seem true to me. But there is this other angle. I mean, there's a lot of angles to this story, which is why it's fascinating. But there's this other angle that he somehow botted the system. There's people in the chat room talking about that now, that he somehow botted iTunes and artificially inflated the download numbers and the review scores to create a success where there wasn't one. Patrick, what do you think about that side?
I mean, it's possible. I've read up on this. This has mostly been proposed by one. I don't want to call him a blogger because that comes across as condescending. But I read it on a blog, and I unfortunately don't know the author offhand. But essentially, what he articulates is that there is a method of gaming the App Store, because the App Store's charts are for free games, which Flappy Bird is, and makes all of its money off of ads, not in-game transactions or paying for it. Is that there are ways to create dummy App Store accounts, and then those dummy App Store accounts download the game, and then those downloads are tracked by Apple, and then as a result, the algorithm moves up the game. So you can kind of create an artificial virality of the game, and then once it's gone viral, people write about the fact that it's viral, which perpetuates the fact that it's gone viral, and, you know, it all snowballs and continues from there. And, you know, I'd say it's possible. Unfortunately, I've not done enough research, nor did the report that I did see, you know, necessarily seem compelling enough to say that's, you know, absolutely what happened. But it's possible. I just think that the byproducts of what have happened since sort of make it irrelevant or the least interesting part of the story. Because I think, you know, as Jeff, you touched on, like, a lot of this surrounding stuff, like the success, the money, often become ways for people to justify bad behavior that they engage in by themselves and feel like they're in a vacuum when they're really part of a larger public discourse that on the internet, we've just come to accept a lower tolerance for what people say. If you were to send a letter to someone threatening to kill them, you'd be arrested. Right. But on the internet, when you threaten to kill someone, unless it's the president, we don't do anything about it. We just say you should deal with it. And I have a real problem with that.
Yeah, so do I. And it's not just the death threats. I mean, that is the most extreme version of this.
Sure.
But just there is a level of vitriol and abuse that is out of control. And I think this new era that we have wandered into sort of unprepared, which is this direct contact, one-to-one contact between people who create things, people who put themselves in the public eye, people who are out in the world publicly with individuals at any time, all the time. I think that this Phil Fish situation here with Flappy Bird, these are going to happen. And even as you brought up, Christian, with Shia LaBeouf and the sort of direct criticism of his stuff, you know, deserve it and undeserve it. But the way that people can interact with others in the public eye who they don't know personally now, I think that we're in the middle of a sea change that I think is going to have ramifications that we're not really aware of yet. I mean, I think that you're going to see more and more of these people who may not be emotionally equipped to deal with that kind of thing. I know, I mean, even myself, who I feel like, you know, I got a little bit of a tough skin. Not, I mean, I'm a kind of a sensitive guy, but that stuff affects me every single day. You know, I can ruin my day reading some horrible thing written by some person who I don't know. And these, there are fragile people. There are creative people whose work we want to enjoy. I don't know. I hate to turn this into an indictment of the internet, but I think that's kind of what this story is.
And thanks for listening to our show on the internet.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I feel like that's sort of where this story leads me.
Well, no, it's both sides, right? Like the greatest thing about the democratization of the internet, which hopefully continues to happen, less court rulings trying to take that away in the United States, is that, you know, we are able to put things like this out into the world. You know, Patrick and the guys at Giant Bomb have, you know, quick views that go out and all the great content that they put out, and people can put up Let's Plays and you can make a name for yourself. And, you know, the Workaholics guys can get their stuff discovered and then develop Workaholics and have this great TV show. But the flip side of that is then access to the content creators that otherwise wasn't available. Like you said, Jeff, you couldn't go, you know, just see George Lucas or just randomly be like, I hate George Lucas, and have him hear that. And now that's very much the case. And I think we'll find that balance. I mean, Twitter's already trying to play with it where you can just see at replies of people that you follow. For a while, they had a thing. They beta tested a thing, I believe, where if you didn't follow the person and they at replied to you, you wouldn't see it at all. And then the internet kind of reacted against that. Like, that wasn't quite the right balance, because just because I don't follow someone, maybe I don't know their Twitter account, I might still be interested in what they have to say. So I think, you know, the world's trying to figure this out, the internet world, but it's not there yet. But I think it's a little quick to judgment to just say it's horrible. Maybe I agree with you. If we just say that people are horrible, then I'm on board. But otherwise, I think we'll figure it out. I have faith.
Well, I'm glad you do. I just hope we can find a way to be civil. And I don't know. It's a scary situation when you have, you know, Flappy Birds. Whatever. It's not, you know, the Mona Lisa, but there are going to be people, and as we move forward, who are affected by this that could be creating really wonderful work. And I, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Christian, you got a different story of the week?
So I think in terms of voting, I have to agree. The multifaceted Flappy Bird saga of candy is by far the story of the week. What I think has potential to become, and what I would nominate as second place story of the week, is Amazon's acquisition of Double Helix. Double Helix made most recently Killer Instinct for Xbox One, and they're working on Strider for Capcom.
God, I know. I'm so excited about Strider. God,
I
loved that game when I was a kid.
Which should be out very soon. But now Amazon owns them. And what I think is interesting about this is, I mean, there have been rumors of an Amazon console for a while. Patrick, say nothing if it's true. Okay, great. And, you know, they're acquiring these studios. So I think the reason that this story is interesting and has potential to be a second place story of the week is, what will Amazon's entrance into the games space look like? What will their entrance into the console space look like? Will it be a Kindle, you know, home console thing that people have been clamoring for Apple to make for years? I mean, I think they're building their book, right? And I think they're trying to do it the right way by acquiring low value or low cost, but competent creators to make something and then put it out there and not just rush something to market. Jeff, what do you think about like an Amazon console, or does this matter to you at all? Or do you think it just will be an OUYA or a blip in the radar kind of in the gaming landscape?
Well, I'd like to first point out that second place story of the week is First Loser. We've established that in the show. And
just like the Winter Olympics are the first loser between the Summer Olympics.
Right. Anyway, I think Amazon has an established track record of with what they did with the Kindle Fire is creating something that is the less expensive version of a high-end product, and been very successful with that. I mean, they're the alternative to spending, you know, $500-$600 on an iPad. And they've shown that they can carve out a market niche and do very well that way, and provide something to a market that wouldn't have gotten into tablets without being able to get in at a low price point. So the idea of them doing the same with consoles and saying, oh, you don't have to spend $400, $500 on a big, shiny new console in your home. You can spend a lot less than that, have the confidence that it's an Amazon box that's going to have a lot of support. It isn't going to go away. You know, it is the rumors swirls around them creating something that's Snapdragon based, that's Android based. For me, that's not particularly compelling. I'm not super excited about putting that in my home. I didn't rush out and buy an Ouya. But I think there will be a portion of people for whom this might be a gateway into gaming. And I think that could be cool. What do you think, Patrick?
So yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this lately, because I mean, the idea that Amazon is working on a machine of some sort, that, I mean, that's established. They are, you know, what they release, when they release it, if they release it, is a question. But they absolutely have been working on an Android based box. I mean, they're familiar with forking Android because they did so with the Kindle Fire. And the way I look at what Amazon is trying to do, you know, the problem they run into upfront is content, right? So, you know, if just making an Android device guaranteed success, then the Ouya would have done better. You know, the Game Stick would have done better. You know, a lot of these things that people invested in on Kickstarter and other places, because the potential is really interesting. But then most people bought it, realized there were no games, and then used it to emulate games that they have boxes up in their up in their attic. So the real problem that Amazon has going forward is about content. And so Double Helix starts them down the path of doing, you know, their own original content. And the one thing I started to think about was that, what if the box they produce maybe is capable of running some basic level of games, but isn't necessarily, you know, going to compete with an Xbox One or PS4. But what if it was a streaming service? Now, Amazon already has a really big, profitable, up and running cloud service called AWS. I forget what it stands for, but it operates a lot of different things, including parts of iCloud. But AWS is a huge cloud networking service that Amazon already runs. What if part of your Amazon Prime account was a streaming service for video games? So maybe they would be creating original content to go on the box, but what if they just started making deals with Sega and all these other older companies to emulate old games to go through a streaming service through their box, which would solve a huge content problem for them while they work towards having original games for their own box? And if that was something that was like part of Amazon Prime, like you buy the device, then you get access to a bunch of games just like you do with Amazon Instant Video or whatever their service is called, that's probably something I'd pay $100 for.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, on the movie side, they have the two tiers of – they have the slate of movies that come with your Prime, and then they have the other ones that you can only get per purchasing a la carte. And I wonder if that's how that would work with video games. It's a very compelling idea to say, wow, there's a streaming service that I'll get with my Prime account that I'm already paying $70 a year for. This is just more thing. Yeah. And if I can rush out and buy that box for like $200, now I'm streaming video games. That's pretty awesome and pretty compelling. And all of a sudden, now Amazon is this pan media company that has arms and all kinds of different forms of entertainment. That would get me excited. The thing that I'm worried about is, you know, the same refrain we've had over and over and over with these streaming services, with PlayStation Now, with On Live, with all this. Like, is it going to be good enough? Is it going to be an experience that's going to rival playing stuff on my console? Because I'm kind of always obsessed with the newest, latest, best experience that I can get. I don't want to play iOS games on my big TV, and I don't really want to play sort of, you know, degraded streamed versions of stuff. Maybe I'm a little too elitist in that respect, but is that something you'd be excited about, Christian?
I mean, saying you don't want to play iOS games on your big screen, I think most people would agree with that, but that has a negative connotation to it, right? I mean, technically an iOS game is XCOM, You know, that's a great iPad port. San Andreas is one of the best versions of Grand Theft Auto. San Andreas is one of the best versions of that game, aside from, you know, the touch controls, touchscreen controls. Pac-Man DX is an iOS game that's really great. What's the Ouya Tower? Mind drawing blank. It was the Ouya exclusive, but it's coming to Steam.
Towerfall.
Thank you.
Put some Titans in that, it'd be awesome.
And release it 2 weeks later for Xbox 360. I think there's potential for that type of game. And I think, like Patrick was talking about, that older catalog stuff could be great. But yeah, I mean, Jeff, your point is the point that needs to be proven, is that latency isn't an issue, because the original Sonic games are great. Sonic CD is my personal fave, but you know, that game doesn't work if your jumps are delayed. You're not going to make it, you're not going to make it through the level like you want to. But, you know, Garnet was saying in the chat for the AWS, it's a very real thing, right? And games are already run through it. And so while this would be a bigger step for it, it does seem like, what Patrick was saying, I mean, they have the infrastructure somewhat in place. So is it that big of a leap for them to then take this next step and really fine tune it? I wonder if on that box, it'll say you must have upload speeds of X, instead of saying you can't play this on a cable, on a dial up, is that the next thing? You must have 500 or, whatever, upload download speeds to run the box effectively.
It's interesting. We got a lot of people on the line. I want to get to a phone call right away, but first we got to thank our sponsor, a New Relic. If you've got a web or mobile application, you need to know about New Relic. New Relic is a developer's best friend because it's easy to use and it has analytics that gives developers powerful code level visibility into real-time performance of their applications. This means you can spot bugs, see bottlenecks, and fix problems fast before they ever affect your users. Thanks to New Relic, you no longer have to ship an app to production and then helplessly wait around hoping for the best until negative app reviews and tweets start to pour in. New Relic empowers software engineers by showing them what's working and what isn't, all in real time. The way it works is super simple. New Relic gives developers a lightweight agent that you unpackage into your production-level apps. The agent sits quietly and securely in the background, gathering real-time metrics across geographies, devices, platforms, all the way down to the end-user level, and then displays all that data in real-time graphs so that coders have total visibility into the performance of their web and mobile applications. So go check out New Relic by visiting newrelic.com/DLC to learn more. And you can use the offer code DLC30 to take advantage of a special 30-day extended free pro trial available exclusively to all the listeners of DLC. You can build better performing apps, get deeper insights, spot bottlenecks quickly, and improve performance with New Relic. As I've been saying on the show, I even had somebody contact me and say they use New Relic not as a developer, but as a way to monitor performance of their computer. So that's really cool. Check it out, newrelic.com/DLC. And the promo code is DLC30. Support them because they support this show and make it possible. And we appreciate it. All right, guys, I'm going to turn to the phones now. We got a bunch of people on the line. There's a call from a 479 area code. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine. How about the other way, Jeff?
Great. Yeah, it works out great. Are you somebody that would be excited about an Amazon console?
A console? No. I think that kind of reminds me of like when you go to a restaurant. It's an Italian restaurant. But they also have like chicken fingers and hamburgers and, like Gordon Ramsay would walk in and be like, what's going on with your menu? What I think Patrick mentioned, oh, and by the way, I just jumped into the very end of his stream while he was screaming in obscenity and dying on the spot. So I did get a chuckle out of that. No, but I think it was Patrick that said a service, like a streaming service would be a lot more, I think it would just make more sense for them, right?
Right.
Because... people have talked about the Steam box and they don't really get what it's supposed to be. Who is it for? And I think you would end up with, you know, similar conversations. Now, one thing I've said is I think the cool thing about something like the Steambox is they get their name in the conversation without really having to have a whole lot of like overhead into like, you know, the research and development that Nintendo, Microsoft and Sony, you know, that, you know, building this console that slapped their name on something and people were talking about it in, you know, like a sphere that they might not have been talking about Steam before, which that's really got to be just a big win for them, right? And so if Amazon did something similar, except maybe just for like a service, I mean, I would love to have old Sega Genesis games streaming on my PC, you know, legally and easily. I think that would be great. But a console? Nah, we've got enough consoles.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I think the idea that Amazon could have a streaming service that's decoupled with any kind of hardware that they would put out, I think that's not particularly likely, but it's an interesting idea. I mean, are you guys into that, Patrick?
Yeah. You know, I think, Jeff, what you were talking about before about, you know, your expectations for how the game would perform, especially over a cloud service, I think is legitimate and specifically applies to folks like all of us that are talking on here. But I think there is a much larger reservoir of people that wouldn't know the difference, or you could get it just good enough that they'd be happy with it. And that, you know, there are other avenues for folks like ourselves that want it running locally and want it, mm-hmm. you know, the precision that we desire and remember and need for the types of games we like to play and enjoy. But, you know, like I had a bunch of people over at, you know, my place this weekend and my Nest kept acting up. I need to get in there and really clean it out. But man, like, wouldn't it have been nice if I could have just, you know, there is the virtual console, but that's its own nightmare of a service that should be much better than it is. But like, hypothetically, you know, if I could have just gone on there and just like, gone to Amazon and clicked, like, paid $3 and bought Mario, like, that would have been awesome. Like, that would have solved my problem. I would have given them money. You wouldn't use an emulator, which is what most people are going to run to. And so I think there is potential there as long as they're able to straddle that line of good enough, even if it might not be necessarily good enough for, you know, the most hardcore of players that would notice the difference.
Yeah. I agree. And I think that it is the idea would be for folks for whom price point is king. You know, it's like it's entry level. It gets you in the door. And now you're hooked on games and now you're, you know, you're one of us. I got another call on the line here. It's from Anonymous. Anonymous. What is your take on this? Hello. Is this John Davison?
Yeah. No, it's Adam from Australia.
Oh, Adam, you our trusty Adam who calls every show. I appreciate this. I thought I recognized that voice right away. Adam, what's your take on Flappy Bird? Are you a Flappy Bird player? Are you sad it's not in the store anymore? And what do you think? What do you think about all that?
Okay, so I've got a lot of opinions on this, but I'll try and keep it brief.
And we lost Adam. Okay, let's go back. I'm kidding.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, I downloaded it a week ago, played it in frustration after an hour or so, angrily deleted it, then went back to it. And I'm a big user of Flappy Bird. I just think the whole story I find so intriguing because at the end of the day, I think it's really this story about sort of overnight successes and really how people being thrust into the spotlight really can't deal with all that success. And I think kind of the pressure of the internet really kind of cracked onto him, and that's why he reacted in the way that he did, and sort of said, oh, I can't deal with this. Let's just get rid of the app and try and undo it. But once you've replicated that success, it's really hard to undo it because, you know, you're in the zeitgeist, you're that popular thing, and that's really hard to sort of navigate. And I think that's really what he had as an issue, and that I think he couldn't deal with all of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's rough. It is certainly rough. It is, there's no, you know, you can go to school for making video games. You can go to school for computer science and programming. There's not really any school for how to deal with being thrust into the spotlight and having your game downloaded by 50 million people. And maybe that's something that we need to think about is, you know, it's rare. It's not something that everybody's going to have to go through. But I would say even the smallest of games, even the smallest of media properties that gets put out in the world is going to get some feedback. And chances are some of that feedback is going to be pretty harsh. And it's not an easy thing to deal with when you put your heart and soul into something and you love it and you build it with your own hands. And then all of a sudden, there's people telling you it sucks. You know, sometimes those things are good and you need to hear them. And other times those things are crushing and you want to take your ball and go home as these designers have. It's a tough thing. It's a tough thing. I don't know. I don't think that there's an answer, or maybe you guys disagree.
No, I mean, I would say that you're touching on a larger thing that I think about a lot, which is essentially the lack of education that we give to especially the youth in regards to the internet. You know, I think part of the reason you see such a proliferation of abuse and other negative things that happen on the internet is partially because, you know, there's been no social reinforcement that you have to act how you do in real life on the internet. And, you know, I think part of that is education that needs to happen at a young age about, you know, what are privacy settings? Like, how do you use right. things like that? You know, I mean, companies like Facebook have tricked people into sharing more than they actually ever wanted to. And they've made sharing norms adjusted over time because they've gotten people into a free service that they really like, connects them with their friends and their family, and then gotten them to overshare often without explaining the consequences as a result. And I think if there was I really think these days when, you know, starting in elementary school, you know, there should be a sense of education about how you use the internet, how to conduct yourself on the internet, and all that stuff is tied together. And, you know, I think makes sense to start at a young age so that people because it's part of their youth. Like, you know, kids are playing Minecraft, kids are on YouTube. And unless they're being taught some sort of values of how to act on there, it's not a surprise that people end up acting their worst and feeling like nothing's going to happen because of it.
Yeah.
I think, and I hope we'll get there. Part of the reason is, you know, the people that are teaching are older and haven't grown up with it. So it's new to everybody. And the youth, the kids, are the ones that are experiencing it firsthand. It's kind of like gaming. You know, we now, like, parents are gamers, whereas before it was less likely. So you see that education going and happening. I think it was Rare, you know, years ago, some of the guys at Rare gave an interview and it was like, what did you do to get into the gaming business? And they just said, oh, no, don't do what we did, because there is no way we would hire anyone that did what we did. Like, now people go to school for years to do what we do. We just stumbled into it at the right place at the right time. And I think social education, social media education, is just starting to happen. But Jeff, do you have any other stories? I know we spent a lot of time on Flappy Bird and we only scored a score of 6 on that conversation.
It's typical. Yeah, I got a pick for a story of the week, and that would be DICE. DICE, of course, the big convention that happened this last week, and they had an award ceremony. I thought we could just quickly review the awards that were handed out at DICE. Of course, the big winner, Last of Us. I know, Christian, your favorite game of last year. Hard to argue with that one. It swept several categories. Adventure game, game of the year, of course, being the premier one. Interestingly, outstanding innovation, Last of Us also won, which I feel like you have to define your terms if you're talking about innovation. Like, what exactly is, I mean, there is innovation in Last of Us, but outstanding innovation? What, you know, looking at some of the other contenders in that category, like Tearaway, and, you know, it's hard for me to say, well, Last of Us was the most outstanding innovation of the year, but great game. I was super pleased to see Best Family Game go to Mario 3D World and Best Mobile Game go to Legend of Zelda Link Between Worlds. Both of those were in my top of the year lists. So pretty good, I would say pretty good rundown of awards. What do you guys think?
You know, I definitely have noticed, you know, at this point, so many awards ceremonies have happened, like they kind of just go over. Once I finish like picking out mine, like I can't think about ranking games anymore. It's like too heartbreaking to go back and look at the games I had to cut from my own list or from our site's list. And yeah, I think you touch on something with, you know, the innovation award. You know, certainly could see an argument for technical excellence or technical innovation in terms of The Last of Us. But innovation is just such a – I don't like that term at all unless right. you're going to break it down into multiple categories because I think it means different things to different people. I think you could have easily made that technical excellence and, you know, design innovation or something along those lines that, you know, allowed for games that excelled in different ways to both be recognized. And I think the phrasing of that category ends up being really limiting as a result. It's like, is Last of Us not qualified? Well, you know, it depends on what you consider innovation. You know, that wouldn't have been my choice if we're talking just more broadly speaking. But I think that has more to do with the problem inherent to the word than necessarily the choice that they made.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah,
I think you can just add presented by do at the end of it, and it really clarifies it for me.
Well, you know, DICE is about more than just awards. It's a place for developers and creators to convene and share ideas. And there were a bunch of fantastic talks. I hope people are keeping tabs. There's a lot of sites that were giving summaries of some of the great talks. One that I picked out that I wanted to bring up with you guys this week is this talk by Hilmar Vigar Peterson, whose name I'm sure I mispronounced, who works on EVE Online and was contextualizing the community and the world of EVE Online in the greater idea of what creates value in a marketplace, any marketplace. He compares it to Starbucks and anything else, where he came to this realization that every single item that you can acquire, your ship, basically, in EVE Online is born of work. It can't just pop into the world like other games can. It is born of work from the player community, and therefore it has intrinsic value. And he was, as a designer at CCP, he had borrowed a friend's ship and it got destroyed, and he wanted to replace it. And instead of just pushing a button, which he could have as the designer to replicate the ship and then all of a sudden, you know, magic band-aid, nothing, no problems, he realized that there was the only value that the ship had was in the work that was put into creating it. So he spent weeks and weeks assembling all of the items he needed to create the ship again from scratch, because he didn't want to devalue that ship. He didn't want to undermine the whole economy. And I would argue that, and as does he, that that is how any economy works. I mean, we're seeing that with cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, and these currencies that are mined, that are literally breaking things down to their base value because they're equating work with value. So because they need to be mined and you have to put in hours to mine them, that work is translated into currency. It's a pretty deep topic and one I'm fascinated by, but I'd like to contextualize it with you guys in the sense of, do you think, I mean, he ends his talk saying that gaming in the golden age is going to involve a lot of things like EVE Online, but that are easier to accept as reality. So he says that when we add things like the Oculus Rift, or anyone that's read Ready Player One will attest that, you know, this idea of once you can enter a more realistic world, that most things in that world will have to come from base component parts that players will need to invest in, so that the world maintains a sense of value and that it's not a frivolous thing. That, for example, as you bring up, Patrick, in Spelunky, like, it has meaning when you die in that game. You can't just respawning doesn't give you the same experience. You're not, there is a sense of value because you invested time into this thing. What do you guys think about that? I've been kind of rambling on, but what do you think about this idea that, you know, in the sort of post-Eve, post-Minecraft world where stuff is made up of other stuff that people created, do you think that's the future of games?
Well, I think there's definitely this idea of time investment, I think, is really critical to that. I think the idea that, you know, as you point out, Spelunky, or in the case of EVE Online, like, the reason people become invested in these worlds are time. And the games respect your time. The games give you something back in exchange for the time you put into it. And I'm not surprised that then people become singularly obsessed with single games as a result, because the time, what they're getting back from the game in exchange for their time is so fulfilling. And if the games are designed in a way to be open-ended, maybe you don't need to go anywhere else for those experiences, which is why you see people get so deep into Minecraft or EVE Online or, you know, Spelunky or any games of those nature. And, you know, these days there is so much competing for your time. There's so much that you can access easily and for not that much money. It makes sense that people then start to equate time itself as a currency that they use in terms of, you know, what they spend their lives with.
Right. Especially in the context of the free to play world. I mean, really, time is your currency. It's, well, I have all these options because it's not costing me any actual human money to play them necessarily. In that universe, I have to be judicious with how I spend the currency that I do have, which is time, which is kind of what I was talking about earlier with saying, well, I don't know if I want to even want to jump into this Spelunky world because I know it would suck me down the rabbit hole. And I want to use my chunks of time in more diverse ways. You know, I don't want to be the guy who plays 1,000 hours of Dota, even though I think I would probably love that. I just need to chunk up that time differently and spend it in more different ways. What about you, Christian, Mr. I've Got a Baby? How do you chunk your time?
Yeah, I mean, well, I'll be honest. Like, you know, you had mentioned, or this, you know, off show, I was aware that the story could come up. And probably a third to two-thirds of it was a little over my head, not in terms of I'm not smart enough to understand it, but I don't know if I, for me, where it initially goes is a scary place, where is this talking about just, you know, overstimuli and that people are going to, like, I hope I'm using these terms correctly, but, you know, like the experiments where a baby bird shuns its mother for a replica mother because the replica mother, you know, has more engaging marks on its beak, or the mother bird neglects their baby bird because the replica bird has a bigger mouth opening. And is this creating the world where we create these worlds that we have to manufacture the thing, and the world itself has value because of the time we put into it? Is it that scary place of VR that, you know, was the fear in the late 80s or 90s, where it's like, and, you know, you come out of there and you look like you're just a drug addict and your eyes are bloodshot and you're pale and you never leave your house because you are
We're there already, bro. I mean, that's called World of Warcraft.
You know, well, right. So, I mean, is this the next step of that in this terms of engagement? And so I know that that's not what his point was in this talk, but that's where I kept going. And then the reason I think the rest of it, or a large chunk of it, is over my head, is that I've never, for whatever reason, that type of investment doesn't scratch that satisfaction itch for me. Like for me, I think maybe because my time is limited, but I have learned more and more as a gamer personally, the type of game I enjoy is a strong narrative, oftentimes single player story, where I go in and I'm making progress through a world that someone else has created and then I'm enjoying, versus me going in and building the world. Like, I like Legos in real life, but for whatever reason, it doesn't translate into me liking the satisfaction of doing that in game. And I've just become comfortable with me as a gamer knowing that's not for me.
Let's ask a caller. We've got a caller on the line from 312. Are you somebody that wants an experience that is deep and longstanding? You play very few games, or are you somebody that wants to play all the games for a short period of time?
Hello. My name is Mario from Chicago.
Hey, Mario. Two Chicagoans on one podcast. What?
What?
Crazy, and it's cold.
Yeah.
But back to your question. I like the idea that I've actually gone through that experience, not so much with the game Pokemon for my 3DS, but, you know, there's a different, you know, value set for that. There have been games where I've actually paid money to, you know, help myself progress and hopefully keep myself going, but I don't see that as being the be-all end-all of this genre. You know, I equate Minecraft, where it's sort of like you just build the thing and then that's the thing. Like, you pay the one price to play the game and that is your game. I don't really enjoy pretty much the idea in the future that there's places like EVE Online where people could spend thousands of dollars on building ships and stuff like that, and then all of a sudden a world like World War II event happens and everyone decides to destroy it all. I don't want to get too crazy and play my games like that.
Right. Peter Molyneux agrees with you. Another big story this week is Peter Molyneux's criticism of a new version of his own game, Dungeon Keeper, that came out on mobile and was free to play, but had microtransactions littered through it. EA got a lot of criticism for this version of Dungeon Keeper, and Peter Molyneux is among them. This story was submitted using hashtag DLCSOTW by at rhole. I think it's pretty amazing that I love Peter. The guy is always great for a soundbite. The fact that he's out in front saying, hey, all I wanted to do was build a dungeon. Why do I have to pay out? Why am I being asked for money constantly? I think that's pretty cool that a creator would come out in front and be critical like that. But then Peter has never been afraid of causing, you know, controversy. Patrick, what do you think about this?
You know, it's the free-to-play model is on its face should be a revelation. It allows people to play games without spending any money. And the term game has a lot loaded into it. A lot of that's generational. A lot of that is people's, you know, maybe prior experience, for better or worse, often worse with video games. So when a game is free, and when you think of things like the App Store, people don't think of stuff on the App Store as software or even necessarily games. They're just stuff they get for their phone. It's why my mom can download apps on her phone and not be scared, but the idea of installing software on her Mac terrifies her, even though they're the exact same thing. It's all how it's presented. And so free-to-play in its most ideal form is incredible because it would allow people to engage with games, discover games in a way that they wouldn't otherwise because they don't want to spend the money and then find out they don't like it. And what's unfortunate is that, you know, free-to-play is being just raked over the coals by the most exploitative of companies. And they're using it in the worst possible ways and start to get into a really weird part of video games that I struggle myself with. I hate the term addictive. And the reason I hate the term addictive is because in any other context, addictive is a horrible word that you would not want to be associated with.
Yeah.
But we use it very casually in games to describe a certain mentality that is legitimate. And
a certain
isn't
joy.
And isn't exploitative of psychology. But, you know, addictive in any other form is exactly that. And so I kind of take issue with that word, but I also know what people mean by it. And when you start to get into what's happening with free-to-play, you do any sort of like just cursory psychological research, and it gets really disturbing very quickly. And, you know, I've heard little things about how companies like Zynga, you know, engage in their focus testing, the kinds of things they look for. I think if people found out, they would be like awfully disturbed at the level of detail they look at how your eyes dart around a screen to determine how they lay out an interface. And
Things like that are interesting.
Things like that are useful. But I think there are a lot of companies that are using it morally, ethically, irresponsibly, and they're ruining what should be a really good thing for the medium in general.
And when you look at how the ramifications it has in what is basically slicing off little bits of game and selling those game little bits to you, you know, a little bit at a time. This story this week also of Metal Gear Solid 5 being the
Ground Zeroes,
right? Being put out as a prologue, as its own thing that's going to cost between $20 and $40 when, you know, multiple Metal Gear Solids have come out with prologues in the game that you bought. And there's this conflict of feeling like, well, we're going to get a little bit of this new Metal Gear Solid sooner, but we're also going to have to pay more for that privilege. And we're in this weird nether realm of how to sell digital stuff. And it kind of relates to that Dice Talk that I brought up in the sense of when you have value imbued into digital things, I don't think we've quite figured out, you know, I know when I go to the carpentry store and the carpentry store, that's thing. the furniture guy had to buy the wood and had to put it together and had certain sweat equity put into it. And like, I go, okay, I'm pay, you know, $100 for the chair. That's really nice. I get that. But this digital thing, I don't think we've figured it out yet.
You know, I think with Metal Gear specifically, I think a lot of the attention started with the length of it, right? Game Informer played it and was able to get through the main campaign in about 2 hours for this prologue. I think when you look at the nuance of what people are upset about, and the response from Kojima and other developers has been, people shouldn't be allowed, or it's inappropriate to dictate to a developer how long their game should be. I think that's actually true, but I don't think that's the argument players are making. I think what they're saying is that 2 hours for a $40 experience, if you're buying the next gen versions of, I guess it's current gen now, of Ground Zeroes, is grossly irresponsible and does not respect the player and sounds like it's exploitative of Metal Gear fans. That's the problem there, I think, is the price they're charging for the experience they're offering. Not the fact that it's 2 hours, but if it was 2 hours and they were only asking $10, I think people might be a little more into that. You know, no one was upset how much that game company charged for Journey, because the price matched the experience and it was long as it needed to be. But with Metal Gear, $40 is a lot of money. And
but don't you think it's going to sell like gangbusters?
Yes, I'm not saying that it's not the right move on Konami's part. Like, it's cynically the right move.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it feels like everybody's going to, complain about it, but nobody's going to not buy it. It that's the crazy part, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and that's on players to have more respect for their wallet and more respect for their own time to really show companies that it's not worthwhile to do that. And, that's the bigger problem. I mean, there's the famous example from years ago where I believe it was Modern Warfare 2 wasn't going to have dedicated servers on the PC. And there was a Steam group that was created by all the people that said, do not buy Modern Warfare 2. If Infinity Ward's not going to respect us to do dedicated servers on the PC, then don't buy the game. And then someone took a screenshot of that group on the day of release, and everyone was playing Modern Warfare 2. But people want to play the game, right? Like, they want to stake out a moral ground or an ethical ground. But at the end of the day, they want to play the games. And that's where the real tension between, big business and fandom and players gets really murky, because it really can be exploitative. And I don't blame people for being excited to want to play Ground Zeroes if that's their favorite franchise. It's really tough.
Yeah. Well, I think the Call of Duty example for what I'm about to say is a little different, but I think like the Ground Zeroes thing, what this might be an example of is that the vocal minority on the internet is just that. And it's a reminder that those who yell the loudest often aren't the most numbered. And I think, a lot of people are upset about this, and some of them probably will buy it, and some are objecting to it on moral grounds. But I also think a lot of people might be perfectly okay with it. And it's that, with the mobile gaming, what Jeff, you're talking about before with, praying or having it be addictive and, using data and understanding that kind of stuff and, tapping into the type of brain, the part of the brain that gets people hooked on gambling. I think that's a different issue. But for this type of thing, for Ground Zero specifically, it's the quote unquote beauty of the free market. And they will release the game at the highest price that they can release it to make the most money for them. And is $40 that number? Maybe not. But, they're trying to maximize their profits and to some extent potentially trying to pay to make the rest of Metal Gear Solid 5, right? I mean, to some extent, this feels like, here's this thing. We did this. If this does well, it'll help fund the development of the next thing. And if this price point isn't right, I mean, I think oftentimes people say, well, we just need to close our wallets and not vote with our wallets. People do that. And if it
you
doesn't,
said
I did. Sorry. Sorry. If it doesn't happen with this game, then I think the same thing is said. People are voting with their wallets, and they're voting that $40 is okay. Like, I personally didn't buy GT5 Prologue because that wasn't worth it to me. But it did phenomenally well for Sony, so it was worth it for a lot of people. And I, the positive person in me thinks that we will figure out this balance. And while it might stink, like, that seems too expensive, I think people will choose to not purchase this game because of that. I don't think that'll be most people, though, and I think that's okay. And I think I hate to be the jerk defending Konami's actions here, but I think it's okay.
All right. Christian Spicer coming down as the jerk defending Konami's actions. We're going to take one more call before we move on to some other topics, including some of the games we're playing right now. But I wanted to talk to this person from the 407. Are you a Metal Gear Solid fan? Are you going to buy this? What's the deal?
Oh, hey, Jeff. Hey, Christian. Hey, Patrick. I'm great to talk to you about all of you guys. I am a Metal Gear fan, but I think I would definitely probably wait for the Ultimate Edition that's going to come out eventually. They'll have everything packaged in, just buy it that way. And I feel like eventually it's going to come as DLC. But the main thing I wanted to ask you guys, especially since you had Patrick on the air as well, is about that massive Eve battle. And that got me thinking about, you know, MMOs and the future of MMOs. And I was wondering, do you guys want MMOs that are more free and open to come in the future, like Eve, or are you more in the World of Warcraft, like, you know, a good ride, like amusement park ride school of thought regarding where MMOs should go in the future?
That's a good question. I think for me, I'm greedy. I want both kinds of experiences. I would love to be able to try both kinds. I'm very excited about games like Elder Scrolls Online that are going to have a really rich story-driven experience that I can feel like I'm part of this established world with established lore. And I'm also excited about things like EverQuest Next, which is going to allow for people to create items and inject their own creativity into the very architecture of the MMO itself. So I have a hard time coming down on one side or the other. I just am glad that we get both. What about you guys?
Yeah, I wish unfortunately, I've never played an MMO. I think Jeff and I,
played an MMO? Really?
No, you and I have talked, before? I think talked a little bit about this on our morning show when you were on, I've never, I sidestepped the World of Warcraft thing largely because, MMOs are a huge time sink and one experience, and I'm someone that likes to try and dip my toes into a lot of different video games. And, you know, playing Spelunky has certainly taught me the value of spending a lot of time with a single game that you don't get out of just sort of being a tourist in a game, you know, just kind of jumping in, playing for the, you know, standard single player experience and then moving on. I wished Elder Scrolls was going to be that game, but the response to that game so far critically seems to be it's, you know, a game that was constructed as a WoW competitor in a world that is kind of moving on from those kinds of games. So maybe Elder Scrolls is not going to be the game that gets me to try one, but maybe not the best person to ask about the future of MMOs, although I do like reading about them.
I loved what you wrote this week on your Worth Reading article on Giant Bomb about sort of your discovery of new genres that you didn't think you would like or mm-hmm. rediscovering games that you only surveyed previously and then put more time into and discovered you actually did like them when you thought you didn't. I think that's a really wonderful lesson just in life, but also in gaming being willing to get outside your comfort zone and try things that you don't necessarily think you would like. And then all of a sudden, wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. So yeah. You know, that. I mean, and you need gateway games for those sorts of experiences. You know, it's not like if you're going to get into strategy games that you should just jump into Crusader Kings. That's really off on the deep end there. But, you know, XCOM was this perfect entry level game into the strategy genre that was great for people that really loved that genre, knew a lot about it, but was perfect for beginners. And then, you know, I jumped from, you know, XCOM to Fire Emblem, and then, you know, I just played the Banner Saga, and I'm, you know, looking forward to playing more of those games. And, you know, it's been really rewarding. And my experiences with all of those strategy games, which are brand new to me, are more permanently sort of ingrained in my mind than, you know, the seventh shooter that I've loaded up that I've had that kind of experience a million times before. And it doesn't mean there can't be quality shooters or quality first-person games that I'll enjoy, but they all kind of become a blur when it's mostly what you play, and it's harder for those games to stand out as opposed to having, you know, just genuinely new experiences.
I feel like that used to be, friends, like real-life friends, at least for me as, in my 30s, when I was gaming. And also, I think it used to be that way because maybe I'm wrong, but as I remember it, not as many games were coming out, right? I feel like I had a Nintendo, and then there was a Super Nintendo and Genesis, and it was kind of the next big release that people were talking about at school would maybe be a different genre than the game you've played before. Or on the computer, on the PC, it's like, oh, King's Quest is out, and that's the game that gets the buzz. What's King's Quest? Well, it's the game that has the buzz. You go play that, and then Super Mario World's out. Well, what's that? It's the game you gotta play, and then you played that. And I think now it's so much easier to just be comfortable in your niche or in your zone. Like when you go on to the internet and, you know, let's say you go into NeoGAF and you jump into any thread for any game, it seems like everyone in the entire world is an expert on that game. And it's like, oh my God, everyone's playing this game. This is incredible. They know so much about it. But it's just, you can surround yourself with people that have surrounded themselves with that game. And it makes it easier to stay in your pocket, and it makes it harder or more risky to venture outside of it. But I think if you do, and if there are those entry level games, or I think what helps are, you know, podcast and shows, let's plays and stuff like that from people that you trust. I think that's a great way now for people to see if something is maybe for them. But otherwise, it's super easy just to surround yourself with essentially yes men, right, that are like, yeah, this is the next hotness. Yeah, this is the next hotness. And it's just the same stuff you've been playing. And I understand that. I do think it's maybe worth wading into the deep end of different genres sometimes, but I totally understand how that's a scary thing to do and why some gamers, you know, don't want to bother with it.
Christian, the chat room is now chanting, tabletop time. Tabletop time?
I see two people that say
chanting,
that.
Chanting. Yeah. There's an uproar. So we're going to get to that. But first, we have to also thank our other sponsor, FreshBooks. FreshBooks, are you still using Word or Excel to create invoices? Do you use a shoebox of recipes to keep track of your expenses? Recipes. I said recipes instead of receipts. Do you use a shoebox of receipts to keep track of your expenses? Because that's as bad as using recipes. Save time and get paid faster with FreshBooks, the easiest way to send invoices, manage expenses, and track your time. FreshBooks is the simple cloud accounting solution that's helping thousands of new entrepreneurs and small business owners just like you save time billing and get paid faster. With FreshBooks, you can easily create invoices online, capture and track expenses on the go, and get real-time business reports with a few simple clicks. You can try FreshBooks for free. What? For free? How? Well, sign up for free today at getfreshbooks.com. And here's the delicious part. Call back to recipes. FreshBooks is doing this for our listeners, just for DLC listeners. Every day, they're giving a birthday cake away. How cool is that? Recipes. See, it's all a callback. It's just subliminal advertising. To someone who signs up for a new account on this show, for your chance to win, enter DLC in the How Did You Hear About Us section when signing up for your new account. And with FreshBooks, every day could be your birthday. Say it's your birthday. Well, FreshBooks makes it so. Go and sign up, getfreshbooks.com. All right, guys, I want to talk a little bit before we get to tabletop time, to about the things you've been playing. I have been playing a game I know you have been playing, Patrick, and that is Threes on my old iOS device. Threes was designed by the same dudes that did Puzzle Juice, which is another game that I got horribly addicted to. And now I'm horribly addicted to Threes. The concept is pretty simple. It is literally a grid. It's like one of those old, when I was a kid, I had those little picture tile things where the one tile was missing and you could move the tiles around and you try to reconstitute the picture by just sliding tiles. You're sliding tiles this way in this game as well, but the tiles just have numbers on them. They start with numbers 1 and 2, which when you slide together will turn into a 3. And then from then on, you're dealing with multiples of 3. And you can only combine 2 tiles that have the same number on them unless they're a 1 or a 2. So once you create a 3 and then you create a couple other 3s, you can turn them into a 6. And you can turn 2 6s into a 12 and so on and so on. And you're scoring more points. The tricky thing is the only way you can actually move a tile or combine it is if you bump it up against the wall. So you have to slide something all the way against the wall. And you're not just moving a specific tile, you're moving all the tiles that can move. It's simple, it's super addictive. I love this game with my whole heart. I felt like a champion among champions when I scored 7,000 points on it the other day. But and then somebody sent me a capture, a JPEG of them scoring 20,000 points on Twitter. So I was like, oh, well.
The designer of that game, Greg Woland, works. I split time at home, and then I also work out of the Cards Against Humanity office, which is in Chicago, and I'm buddies with those guys. And Greg Woland, who also was a Ridiculous Fishing, is the chief designer on this game, Threes. And if I'm getting it right, I believe that his high score, now obviously he designed the show, but his high score is, which is depressing.
What was it again?
I dropped out there. What was it? What's his? It's what?
Oh, it's around 60,000.
Oh, my
wow.
God.
Which is unfathomable.
I could, for the longest time, I could not break 2,000, and then I shattered it and got 7,000. And it was one of those things where I felt like the best game player of all. I was like, I am a golden god, and tweeted as such. And somebody was like, no, I scored 20,000. I was like, fnarf. So, but it's a great game, and it's only $2, and I'm digging it.
It's so simple. It's one of those games that when I have people over, I just like, hey, you should try this out. And within the tutorial takes like all of 30 seconds to play, and it appeals to audiences like that maybe aren't even into games. Like, I'm not sure people that aren't into games consider puzzle games to even be games as we normally talk about them. They're just puzzles. And when I had folks over for my birthday on Saturday night, I think I sold like 4 copies of Threes as an iPad got passed around the room.
Well, yeah, and you should buy it now.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Belated happy birthday. And you should buy the game now before it becomes super popular after we talk about it on the podcast and it gets taken off the iOS store. You know, you got to jump on this stuff.
Well, I don't play very many games on my phone just because I feel so precious about battery life. But this is one of those games where, like, if I have to wait for any reason at a store or anything, I can just pull it out. I can play a whole game in, 5 minutes, not even 2 minutes. And which is perfect for me for my phone. Patrick, you've been playing Jazz Punk.
Yeah, Jazz Punk, game that came out last week. The best comparison we've been able to come up with is it's kind of like if the movie Airplane was made into a video game. I feel that kind of describes the sense of humor and also the way the jokes are sort of deployed in Jazz Punk. They're
sounds like
fast.
Somebody got my letters is what it sounds like.
Yeah, the jokes are fast, they're furious, there's a million of them, and some of them, it's like, it's lowbrow humor told with highbrow expectations, I guess. And it's just incredibly funny. So few games speak to the spirit of the author. And when you play Jazz Punk, you really feel like you're just kind of getting a comedy show from, I think, Lewis something or other is the designer's name. You really feel like you're getting a sense into his brain when you play Jazz Punk. And just an incredibly funny game, which games are traditionally not very funny because comedy is very hard to do, especially when you have a player responsible to move around in the world. Like, that destroys a lot of normal comedic setups, which is, the comedian has control over everything. It's just highly recommended. It's very funny, and it only takes about 2-3 hours to play. But the nice part is that there's so much you're going to miss that as soon as you look over the achievement list, you're going to want to go through the game again to try and find all the stuff that it's unfathomable that you missed that much stuff, but there's no way you're going to see it all the first time around.
That's awesome. All right, I want to get to tabletop time. Tabletop time! Right now. Patrick, are you a board gamer?
I need to get into more of them. You need a group, right? And I don't really have a group right now, but I have some friends in the...
hang out with the Cards Against Humanities guys.
No, I know. That's exactly what I mean. So
you're married, start having kids, build your group.
That's what Christian's doing.
The Cards office actually has, like, I think something like 100 board games stacked against the wall. So ooh. I have huge amount of that stuff. And so maybe you guys can help me out by recommending something.
Well, my board gaming group this week, I introduced my very favorite board game of all time. And I realized that I hadn't even talked about that on the show yet. So I thought I'd bring it up, having played it real recently. And I love playing it every time I can. And that game is Le Havre. I know. It sounds weird. It's a French name of a place. It's actual. What the heck is it called? A place where boats go. Harbor town. It's a harbor town in France that it's named after. And the game is all about shipping things and building up this harbor town. Sounds fascinating, I know, but this is my very favorite game. It is really about creating goods, making goods in certain ways, collecting goods from the harbor, using those goods to then construct buildings that then can change those goods into more expensive goods, then buying ships and putting those goods on ships, shipping them out and making money. This game is all about who made the most money at the end. But the real twist is that you have to feed your people a certain amount of food at the end of every sequence of rounds. So there are some rounds where you have to give them a little bit of food and then more and more and more as it goes on. So you're constantly having to balance your desire to make money and create your economic engine by investing in certain houses, buildings, and using those buildings to create money. And also, you know, if you build a building, it has value as well, so you can make money that way. But you have to balance that with then creating food for your family. You can get food by fishing. You can get food by getting cattle and then slaughtering that cattle and turning it into meat. You can get food by getting grain and turning that grain into bread. There's all kinds of different ways you can get food, but you have to balance that with making money, which is how you win the game. This is a wonderful game. The thing I love most about it is the fact that there's so many different types of goods that you can get, and you always have a million options that you always want to do. You can collect goods, you can build houses, there's always 12 things that you want to do, and there's always 12 different ways to get closer to being victorious in this game. So it's this overwhelming sensation of having more than enough things to do, which is the opposite of a lot of board games when you feel like, oh my God, I've been limited by how many things I can do. It's a worker placement game. So you have a worker and you can take him into buildings and you can actually take your worker into buildings that other players have built or that other players own. So you're not limited in that way either. This is a game all about reducing limitations and making you feel like, oh, I've got all this great stuff. I can do all these different plans. I have all these different options at any given time. It's also available on iOS. Now, there's a lot of games, tabletop games, that are available on iOS. And for example, Magic the Gathering on Duels of the Planeswalkers. And I say, oh, that's a great way to learn because you can play it by yourself. You can get used to the rule set. Not so much with Le Havre. I find that downloading the iOS app and playing it cold, even though it has a tutorial, it's probably going to be pretty overwhelming and it's not going to make much sense. I don't recommend using the iOS version as a way to learn the game. But once you have played the tabletop version, having the iOS version there, I caught home from my gaming group and was so high on playing this game that I played like 4 games on iOS back to back just because I was like, I still want to get that juice going. Really fun game. Highly recommend it. It's from my favorite game designer, the same guy who designed Agricola and Aura et Labora, and just came out with this game that's getting all these great accolades from our guest last week, Tom Vassell, called Caverna. So anyway, that's Le Havre. It's L-E space H-A-V-R-E, French game. Good stuff. All right. I have there's another question. Of course, if you want to send in questions, we have an email address as well, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. Or you can send them in via Twitter, which @MatthewEckhart, I guess is his name. And I thought this was a perfect one for the guy known as Scoops being on our show. Patrick, he wrote, how do gamer media types get their scoops? How do you do it?
Man, that's a really complicated question. The relationships. I mean, that's probably the very basic level of it. For the stuff that I typically engage in, if you're talking about, let's say, a site like Kotaku, which is like a super high traffic, tons of people going to the site, they have relationships with sources that turn into stories, but they also traffic a lot in anonymous tips. You know, people just kind of sending something in. Like all the stuff that I do is based on relationships I have with different individuals in the games industry that I've cultivated, you know, sort of a mutual relationship with over the course of many, many years. And so sometimes people want to share something. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they have an agenda behind it. Sometimes they don't. And, you know, for me, it's just getting to know more people. So, you know, one of the things that, you know, I often have to do is when I'm going out to something like GDC or PAX East and then, you know, staying out late, drinking with individuals and things of that nature, like you're developing relationships. You're getting to know people and establish trust with people in the industry. And, you know, sometimes that'll play out into whether it's someone providing you with information or it'll pan out into, you know, someone that can verify something that you've heard elsewhere. You know, I have a lot of sources that don't necessarily provide me with anything, but if I need to, like, hey, does this sound like BS? They can shoot it down for me, so I don't spend a lot of time on it. But you know, I think the basics of it are what I started with is that it's relationships. It's, you know, people trust you to not screw them over on them having a job, and I trust them to not feed me false information that'll make me look bad.
Now, do you find that when you're interacting with people in a social context, they get worried that you are mining them for information, or do you feel like it's more, it's a trust is a two-way street and they trust you as well?
I mean, yeah, trust is a two-way street. I mean, like, you know, if I'm new to hanging out with someone where they, you know, we'll make sure and just like, ah, this is all off the record, right? And, you know, just kind of establish that so there's kind of a tone to the conversation. But, you know, by the time you get to know someone well enough, you know, you don't have to say the legal speak of being off the record so that something can't be shared. But yeah, there's absolutely times that, you know, I feel uncomfortable in certain situations where a developer invites me out to, like, let's say a dinner, and there's a lot of developers there. And, you know, the person who's invited me trusts me, but I don't expect everyone else to trust me. And it can be an unfortunate part of the relationship that I kind of have with game developers is slightly antagonistic. You know, it is, and it should be that way. And I don't blame developers for not trusting me. That's something that you have to earn. And there should be some distance. I think at this point, you know, I have established myself enough that folks kind of know what they're in for. And, you know, I have protected all my sources and all the stories that I've done over the years, and no one's ever lost their job. So, once you've kind of done it long enough, your reputation hopefully helps you out, and that stuff kind of just snowballs as you become more experienced and spend more time in that space. And it's just sort of like, hey, you know, you can trust that guy if you want to go to him with something or, you know, want to give him a tip.
Mm-hmm. Or if it was the old EGM magazine, was it EGM that finally said they just made up half of those things?
So, yeah, I think I can probably explain how that worked. It's been long enough. My understanding of how a Quartermaster worked, which is the rumor column you're talking about, is that the reason half of that stuff was made up was to kind of hide the fact that half of it was real, too.
Sure.
So if he was filled with a bunch of junk, yes, it brought down the overall credibility of the column on a monthly basis. But when that stuff did pan out, you went back and looked and like, oh, they were right.
It was camouflage.
It was camouflaged, and, you know, it's meant to protect sources and stuff like that. And I might be making this up, but I feel like this is true, so I'll say it anyway. I want to say that sometimes there were at least a couple of instances where rumors were planted in there because that's what the editors wanted to see happen. And stuff like that snowballs, and there was impact on the industry in a noticeable way as a result of a rumor being dropped. Because the Quarterman column used to be a huge thing.
Absolutely.
And I feel like I've been told that resulted in actual things happening that were complete BS at the time that it was conceived and put in the column.
That's pretty rad, actually.
Yeah, I think that's pretty great.
Yeah. Christian, I wanted to ask you about something because I know you've been playing Lego Marvel recently.
Oh, that's so good.
I went to the Lego movie and was just blown away. I put up a video review if anybody wants to check it out over my YouTube channel, youtube.com/KanataJeff with two N's and one T. And it's just pure joy, that movie. And it made me want to A, play with Legos, and B, get back into Lego video games, because I haven't played any in a while, because I felt like they all got a little samey. You know, it was just sort of a new skin on the same kind of dealio. Sell me on Marvel. You know, I'm a freaking Marvel zombie from way back. So sell me on Marvel and why you love it so much.
So there are no Marvel zombies in this game. While a what? Successful comic spinoff for the Marvel franchise, especially the Spider-Man cover, was a fantastic piece. Lego Marvel is, in my opinion, having played almost all of them except for Lego, the movie, the game, the newest one in which the dog has fully consumed its tail. Lego Marvel Super Heroes is the best Lego game made. It definitely still follows the Lego formula, in that if you are utterly bored of that, I mean, it's breaking things and collecting pieces and, you know, unlocking new guys. But the voice it has, you know, as introduced in, I believe the first DC game was the first Lego game to introduce actual voice acting. It's continued that tradition. The voice acting is solid. And what I really like about this game is I think for the first time, capturing it really, really well, all of the characters, and there are so many characters, play and feel different. Like when you're playing as Captain America, his moveset, like his animations, the way he hit the weight in the world, the speed in which he fights and throws his shield feels like how Captain America would move, versus Spider-Man is, you know, quicker. And while the Lego Spider-Man, you know, he'll make Spider-Man poses, and it makes you feel like you're playing as different characters. Whereas before some of the Lego games, sure, you unlocked, a different character in Star Wars, Qui-Gon Jinn or whatever, but he still felt a lot like Obi-Wan or whatever. This game, all the characters feel very different. It has the open world that was introduced in the DC games and expands on that, and the collectibles and just the range of powers. It's so much fun. It's, for me, one of the best Marvel games ever made, if not my, I should say my favorite, maybe not the best. But it's full of whimsy, Jeff. And if you are a Marvel fan and a whimsy fan, it's easy to recommend this game. However, that said, it's still very much a Lego game, right? Like when you go into missions, it's, you know, you smash through things, smash, a little very easy puzzle, build a switch, pull the switch, go. The puzzles I found have been, they're not difficult, but they're fun. They're clever, and they oftentimes make you smile, especially the dialogue between the characters.
Smiling.
Right, it's fun. Like the quote-unquote dumb characters, like when you're Hulk, you can transform back to Bruce Banner, but when you're Hulk, he'll approach a switch and he can't pull it because he doesn't know what to do. He's like, oh, no. And then, go back down to Bruce Banner and he can hack a console and stuff like that. I don't know if it'll capture... I haven't seen the Lego movie yet, unfortunately. I hope to go this so weekend. I don't know if it will capture that feeling, and it certainly doesn't capture building a set.
That's what I've been thinking about, is because the movie is so much, and no spoilers at all, but the movie is so much about the creativity of Lego, and about, in a large sense, sort of rejecting the just build the instructions version and say, hey, you know, you can make anything with these. And as much as these Lego video games have found a formula that is really entertaining, I feel like there is a missed opportunity with creating a Lego game that allows for that. And let me pitch you on my idea for what would work as both a killer Lego game and that mystery killer app for Kinect. Give me virtual Lego toy box where I sit in front of my television and I use my hands to grab pieces, infinite amount of pieces, any piece that I want that are based on actual Lego pieces, have the catalog there with the numbers, all that stuff. Let me pick them up with my hands, bring them onto the screen, and manipulate it using Kinect with my hands to create stuff in virtual space using Lego. Would you guys dig that, or is that stupid?
It's too smart of an idea. It'll never happen.
I think you'd miss the tactile feel, not of stepping on them late at night, but the
what you give up. And I mean, obviously, if I want the tactile feel, I will go use actual Lego. But what you get in exchange for that is infinite Lego, is the thing that I always wanted as a child slash adult. And that is, I want this one very specific piece that I either A, don't have, or B, can't find. And you be able to do that and create exactly the thing you want. I mean, I think proving the part of Spore that was really fun, of course, was like creating the creatures and stuff and just sticking stuff to stuff, because you had this, it's this set of stuff where you could find the exact one you wanted. Give me that with a Lego. Make me, let me use Kinect to sort of manipulate it in 3D space. All right.
There's a very simple Chrome, I don't know if it's a plugin or I played it in Chrome, but like web version of that. It's very simple. Pieces are limited, but hopefully they expand on that. So there's potential there. Maybe people are listening. Let's call up Quarterman and get them to publish this and make it happen.
Exactly. All right. We're about to wrap up the show, but I want to go have one more phone call. We've got somebody from 661. Do you have a question for Patrick or the rest of the team here?
Hi. My name is Michael. I'm calling from Amsterdam, actually.
Amsterdam, right on.
Yeah. So I've been listening to the show the whole evening, and I don't necessarily have a question. But I did. Okay. I actually did have a question, but I forgot it. But I was intrigued by the whole conversation about Flappy Bird, because I wasn't really sure about the whole story behind that. But I did have a question about board games.
Okay.
I don't have a lot of friends around to play board games with. Does anybody have a suggestion on, you know, what the best way is to find people to play board games with? Or if not, something that you can play with a few people?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one we get a lot. And the stock answer is that I don't know the specifics of Amsterdam, but I would guess if it's anything like here, you can find a whole bunch of people by using your friendly neighborhood internet. The internet's a great place to hook up with groups. I use Yahoo groups. I am a member of several board gaming groups that I met purely through Yahoo groups, and they just happen to be in my area. And I think you'll find one of my favorite things about board games is that the people who tend to use that as their hobby tend to be great people. And I think you'll find that if you stick your neck out a little bit and venture into an area that you don't know anybody, you'll likely find some folks that have common interests and are pretty friendly. So Yahoo groups is a good one. There's like meetup.com, I think is another site that does that. But if you do a Google search for just board gaming groups, I'm sure you'll find a lot. The other option, if you're, not interested in kind of doing that, is there's a whole bunch of board games that are single player. In fact, the one I mentioned today, Le Havre, can be played single player. And playing them on iOS, playing games. There's a whole bunch of board games that have been converted to the iPad and Android devices, and those offer you the experience of playing those games single player as well. So that's a good question. Let's hit one more. We got one more guy on the line here, let's see if we can end the show with a good question. You're on the line from. Where are you from? 479.
479.
How you doing, man?
Doing good. Actually, I was just listening on my phone. This is the second time I've been on, Jeff. So if you want to just hang up on me and give somebody else a shot, that's fine. But I also just wanted to say, I've been listening to podcasts for a long time, since like the old days of One Up Yours. You know, I think that was the podcast that really got me interested in listening to these kind of newfangled radio shows, and I just wanted to give you guys a compliment. I've called in a couple of times, and of course, as somebody who's egotistical or concerned about themselves and want to do, I went back and listened to myself, and it's not easy to talk on the internet like you guys do. I think a lot of times we take for granted you guys just showing up and, you know, just chatting about video games, but listening to myself and, you know, like the dead air and the ums and the, the, you knows, the preparation and like the care that you guys put into it, really makes a difference, man. And I just want to say, I appreciate everything you guys do. It's a fun listen, and I'm just going to say thanks and leave it at that.
Well, I very much appreciate that. That's a very, very cool way to end the show. And of course,
$20 is in the mail.
Yeah, exactly. That's very nice of you. And when you listen to this later, I think you sounded great. Also, a good way to point out that if you aren't able to be near a computer at 11 a.m. Pacific time on Mondays, you can listen to the show by calling in, because you'll hear the show through your cell phone when you sit on hold. So there's that. We appreciate very much that. That's a nice thing to say, and thanks a lot. That's going to do it for this episode of DLC. Patrick, thank you so much for hanging out with us. Mr. Scoops himself on Giant Bomb. Can you let us know where to find more of your stuff?
Yeah, you know, you can follow the majority of my work on Giant Bomb at giantbomb.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. It's just my name, Patrick Klepek, K-L-E-P-E-K. And yeah, this was a ton of fun. Happy to come on anytime you guys will have me.
Absolutely. Yeah, man. It was great. Christian, what about you? What do you got going on this week?
I've been talking about it for a while, but we're in the week. This is a busy week for me. If you're listening to this live, or today, Monday in Los Angeles, tomorrow, Tuesday, is the next live show / stand-up show, live show, stand-up show / podcast I do for the Nerdist Network called What's New. We're at Nerd Melt in Meltdown Comics in Los Angeles. It's at 9 p.m. It's 100% free. My good friend Ben Glebe is going to come headline the show. He's a regular on the Chelsea Lately Roundtable and super funny. It's great. If you can't be there live, you can check out the podcast online. It's called What's New with Christian Spicer, part of the Nerdist Network. Then Thursday is Improv versus Stand-Up at UCB Los Angeles, which is going to be such a fantastic show. So excited for that. And then right after that show, I drive to LAX to jump on a plane to fly to the North Carolina Comedy Arts Festival, which I've been lucky enough to do several years now, and it's so much fun. I'll be there. I'll be doing, I think, a long set of stand-up Friday after I shake jet lag. And then Saturday, we're doing improv versus stand-up out there. We did it there last year, and it was just amazing. And we're so excited to have the show back at the festival. So if you're in the Raleigh-Durham area or have friends that are, tell them about the show. It's a great festival. Rain, snow, sleet, or, you know, God forbid, nice weather. We're going to do those shows. So hopefully flights aren't canceled and I make it there. Otherwise, you can catch me at the Atlanta airport, being stuck there playing Ollie Ollie on my Vita.
Still loving that game, huh?
For too many hours. Yeah, I go between that and I just picked up when it was on sale, Injustice, the complete edition or whatever it's called. It was $20. And those single player fighting games first Mortal Kombat and now Injustice, they're so fun. I mean, they're not like real fighting games when you play like that, but gosh, if it's not a good time. So that's me this week. And then when do you go to Palm Springs? Is that soon? That's soon, right?
Yeah, we got a couple of weeks off, but we start up, I think the 26th of February, we go to Palm Springs and do 39 Steps, which was getting great reviews here. We had our closing night yesterday, matinee was our closing day there. It was a really lot of fun. And some great listeners showed up and saw the show, which I was completely blown away by. It was really cool.
That's awesome.
And if you find yourself at the end of February, beginning of March, in or around Palm Springs, we're going to be playing at the Annenberg Theater there. You can find the information at my website, jeffcanada.com. But tonight, if you're listening Monday, tonight I'm going to be the celebrity guest at a fundraiser / comedy show that I'm really excited about. It's called Broadly Speaking.
Yes.
I'm going to wager my own money in a game that I'm guaranteed to lose. And then all that money will go to charity.
Sounds like a free-to-play game, except for the charity part.
Exactly. So anyway, you can find out that information on my website as well, jeffcanada.com with two N's, one T. I mean, remember, you can send emails to the show, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. We will see you every Monday here on 5x5.tv/DLC. And that'll do it for this episode. I really appreciate you guys being here. Thanks a lot. Until next week, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place. We'll be right back.